Hello and welcome. This is South Jersey Pharmapod, the official podcast of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. I'm Steve Lubetkin of Lubetkin Communications. We produce business podcasts throughout New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance is a group of men and women united to highlight the relationship between the pharmaceutical and medical technology industries and the South Jersey economy. The common interest and goal of the alliance is to advance and protect this critical segment of our area economy. If you'd like more information, you can write to the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance at P.O. Box 147, Riverton, New Jersey, the zip 08077, or you can call 856-303-7632. Membership in the alliance is free. This is episode 2 of the South Jersey Pharmapod. The alliance held its spring conference on May 2, 2006 at the Enterprise Center at Burlington County College in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. In this episode, we'll hear the mid-morning presentations at the conference. And that means first we'll hear a panel discussion on how to lobby. It's moderated by Don Seco, who's executive director of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. The panelists are Rick Lloyd, executive director of government affairs from Johnson & Johnson, Jim Watkins from Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, and Fran Hahn from Sanofi Aventis. The panel is followed by a familiar voice on these podcasts. Yes, it's me. I was a guest presenter at the conference and talked about what else, blogs and podcasts, and how they can be used for business communications. Now let's go to the podium where Don Seco is ready to introduce the presenters for the first panel on the podcast.
Okay, thank you. This next part of our program we entitled How to Lobby, and we are extremely pleased to have three professional government affairs people with us. Three folks who I have been proud to not only lobby alongside of, but to have been lobbied by. I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to let you know that while it's not 100% set, we are looking at June 8th for our Trenton Day, where we will invite legislators to join us at a room in the state house where you can talk to them about issues, and you know, we'll give you breakfast, we'll go see some committee meetings and maybe a floor session. And these folks here will help you a little bit in how to approach a legislator, what to say, what not to say, and the like. From my right and your left, we have Rick Lloyd, who is the Executive Director for State Government Affairs for Johnson & Johnson. Rick has been with Johnson & Johnson since 1993. And been lobbying for them since then. He left the state for a little while to do some lobbying outside the state, but is now back since October as their chief lobbyist in the State House. Prior to that, he was a government affairs representative for Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey. To Rick's left is Jim Watkins, who has 36 years of experience in the pharmaceutical, chemical, and consulting engineering business, with a particular emphasis on government, public, and community relations and environmental affairs. He is currently working for Wyeth. If you look at his resume and his bio, he's been with the same company, but the company has changed names and has morphed into different companies. But he's the one steady influence in the company. When Jim was lobbying me, when I was executive director of the State Assembly, serving as chief of staff to two different speakers, there was an act that they had, good Jim, bad Jim, and Jim Carrey was the other Jim, and I'll let you figure out who was the good Jim and who was the bad Jim. And to Jim's left is Fran Hahn. Fran Hahn is a friend, someone who worked for me and was an integral part of my budget staff. She is now a government relations manager for Sanofi Aventis, and she served in similar positions with Aventis, Pfizer, and Warner Lambert. What I'm going to do here, this is going to be kind of freewheeling. We'll take questions from the audience. I'm going to pose some questions myself, but just to get us started a little bit, I'll let them say a little bit about what they do and how they approach the business. Fran, we'll start with you.
Okay. Good morning, and I'm very happy that you're all here, and I'm very happy that we found you through this organization, this alliance that we have, and it's very nice to get to know many of you. And I was paid by Don Seco to tell you that the highlight of my career was working for him. being a lobbyist, in my mind, really means one major thing, and that means knowing your business, knowing what you have to impart to legislators, being educated yourself on the issues, policy issues that your company or your organization really want you to impart, knowing it so well that you don't even have to think twice about phrasing it, putting it in a comment, because you often only have 30 seconds when you're walking through the Capitol to make a point to someone. If you have an appointment with someone, however, like you're going to be having coming up, I think the important thing is to define just what it is you want to get across and decide what points you want to make and make a little agenda for yourself ahead of time, because nothing is worse than getting off on a tangent and never getting your main point across while you have that few moments with that individual. So the important thing is to be prepared, decide which issue you're going to lobby and lobby that and make your points about it, and always know what your opposition feels about that issue and who your opposition is, because trust me, they're going to be going to a legislator also. So you want to make sure that you cover whatever it is you need to cover that your opposition may be telling them and may be misinforming them about something about your business that may be not accurate. So you may want to make sure that before you decide, you know, what you want to say when you enter the Capitol that day and talk to the legislature, that you really want to understand what your opposition may say about it. And you want to not malign them, but just make those points that you know they might make. The most important thing that I found in all my almost 10 years of lobbying now and my many years in government, the one thing that I can really share with you, that one of the most important things a lobbyist has to have, in my mind, is integrity. Because you don't get a second chance to fix something. If you lie, if you misrepresent, if you in any way, shape, or form mislead anyone, you never have a chance to really correct that. In this business of politics, the first mistake you make is probably going to be your last one. So I really believe firmly that integrity is very important. And when people know that you are a person of integrity, they trust you. And when they trust you, they listen to you. And as a lobbyist, that's what you really want people to do. You want them to listen to you and to trust what you say and to know that you would not lie or mislead them. Because as a legislator, you know as well, politicians can get into trouble very easily when they misquote or often misquoted in the papers and people say they say one thing and they didn't really mean that. So you don't want them ever saying anything about your business or your issues that is not accurate, totally full of veracity, and is absolutely the best possible information they could have on your issue. So always have some integrity. And I want to give other folks a chance, obviously, to speak, and I'll just say a few more words. Just remember, too, that even though you lobby someone, you give them all the information in the world, they go to vote the next day, and they vote no. You're thoroughly frustrated, you're totally upset, and you wonder, what the heck happened? Well, trust me, good politics isn't necessarily good policy, and good policy isn't necessarily good politics. There's a lot of reasons why a legislator, even though they promised you they would do their best, that they would vote for you on that issue. It can't always happen, because sometimes in caucus there's another agenda. There's another reason why, as a group, they can't support what it is you want them to support. But remember, there's no sense in getting angry, no sense in getting upset, because you're going to have to go back again to that well another time. So shake their hand, say thank you for trying, and remember that that relationship that you're building will serve you well in the future, because that relationship will be the key to being able to go in the next time to say hello, to talk again about an issue that's troubling you, something that you want to try to accomplish for your company or your constituency. And believe me, that door will be open to you for the second time and the third time and the next time. And always through it all, remember to always, when they do something good for you, please don't forget to say thank you. because it's very important. And I say this because oftentimes when I support legislators through their political fundraising events, I don't get letters from all of them. But trust me, I remember the ones who sent me a note and said thank you. And I am very more apt to, when I get 65 things coming across my desk, I think I'll do this one. Because that person took the time to thank me for my support. And that means that we have a relationship of some sort and we want to keep building it. So if you have any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them. I want to give my colleagues a chance. As most of you, anyone in the audience know me, I could go on and on about this topic. I could go on about it forever because I love what I do. I love working with people. And just remember, too, they're only people. They have a job to do as well. And your job is to help them understand what your issues are the best you can with as much veracity and with as much sincerity as you have to give them. Okay, and with that, I'll turn to the next person.
Thank you, Fran. Rick?
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Fran. I think one of the things you'll find out after you hear the three of us talk is we're three different people with three different styles, which goes to the fact that there's not one correct way to do this type of work. The other assumption I'm going to make about my audience, which is probably a mistake, is that most of you are at some point in time involved in selling your product, selling your business. Well, that's what a lobbyist does. A lobbyist sells a public policy position to elected officials, and I think one of the things you want to take away from this is because you may say, well, how often am I going to go to Trenton or Washington, D.C. to talk to government officials? But the same techniques you would use to lobby a state legislator or a governor or a senator, you apply to a mayor or a city business manager, and I think a lot of that has applicability as you try to meet people. I'll use my one quote, which is from Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, which is, you don't want to know how laws or sausages are made. That's a funny line, but frankly, if you're in business, you can't afford not to know how laws and public policy impact your business. So I think you want to be involved, you want to understand the political process before you ever have to go into the political process. Some things I think you want to know is, know who your elected officials are. If at all possible, meet them before you have to ask them for assistance. It's always a lot easier to ask somebody for assistance if they already know you. If you're their constituent, I can assure you they or people in their office want to know you. So get to know them before you have to ask them for something. That would be true about a mayor. It's true about a state legislator. When you think about this, elected officials do want to hear what you have to say, especially if you are their constituents, or you employ their constituents, or you contribute to their economy. One of the major ways that we are successful as an industry is because we're a critical component of the economy, and we make people aware of that. The fact of the matter is their constituents are employed by my company. Most of their constituents are buying products made by the companies at this table, and we try to say we're invested in the community. And therefore, you want to hear what we have to say. At the same time, understand these are really busy people, that they are generalists. They have to think about schools one day, prisons the next day, taxes tomorrow, healthcare the next day. So you only get to see them for a little bit of time. Understand that? Understand that appointments for 11 o'clock may switch to 11:30, that the half-hour meeting may become a five-minute meeting, and you should be grateful for the 5 minutes that you get. Don't use technical jargon. That's one of the things that we do all the time. The pharmaceutical industry is a complicated industry. When you try to explain pricing, it gets very technical. Don't get lost in technical jargon. Don't get down in the weeds where the member cannot understand what you have to say. Try to keep it to a situation where anyone would understand your position on the issue. Private meetings are better than public hearings. Try to see people in private. Don't, for the first time, show up at a public meeting to state your concerns, either pro or con, on an issue. When it's public, it means the media is there, you're getting your picture taken, and there may be some people who feel the need to posture to the audience. You can have a lot more effective discussion in private, and in general, go to their office. Don't expect legislators to come to your offices, and candidly, you'll do more effectively in their office in the district than you will in Trenton, because too many people like us are waiting around trying to talk to them in Trenton. So try to meet with them where you can. Work with your trade associations. this group, any other group you're involved with, the chambers, the business and industry associations, to try to get involved in issues that affect your business. When you do meet with them, be deferential. Respect the position and the person. Call them by their title. Even if you know them, I don't call legislators by their names when I'm talking to them on a business issue. I call them senator or assemblyman. You give them the respect that the title that the title deserves. Also, respect their staff. Staff people are really critical. When we really wanted to have effectively lobby budget issues, we used to go lobby Don and Fran because they were the key staff who were immersed in the nitty-gritty. And on budget issues, it's all about the devil is in the details. Know the staff, treat them with as much deference as you would the member, because they are frequently giving the member the technical advice as to, what do you think I should do about this? It sounds kind of complicated. Well, assemblyman, you know, have you thought about it this way? So always treat the member with respect, and that includes the person who answers the phone, because they're the ones who's going to determine whether you get the appointment or not. Be yourself. You're his constituent, you're her neighbor, use your own words. You have a lot of political influence if you're going in to speak to somebody who represents your town. They know there's a multiple rule, the multiple rule of 10. For every person who comes in and talks to you about an issue, there are 10 other people who have the same opinion. They also know that you know lots of neighbors and friends, and if you have a bad meeting with an elected official, and you know, you're going to go out there and say, you know, I always thought Senator X was a really nice guy, but I found out that, in fact, he was like this. So I think that they are interested in hearing what their constituents have to say. With people who are professional lobbyists like us, I mean, you know, we sort of, as the old story goes, what's the difference between a dog and a lobbyist? When a dog stops whining when you let him in. I mean, we go in there and we ask for stuff all the time. And at times they say, enough already, which gets to one other point. When you go in, explain your business. What do you do and why this particular public policy will impact your business? So say, I'm in the following business. If you do this, the following things will occur. Understand also, it's a lot easier to defeat legislation than it is to pass a bill. So if you ever have the choice, it's easier to be in opposition, because in order to pass a bill, you have about 15 steps in the process, and everything has to go right every step of the way. For legislation to get sidetracked, something just has to go wrong in one place. So just understand that it's more difficult to change a law than it is to keep one from being enacted, which is probably why I've been able to be employed all these years. Get to the point, describe your issue. Know the arguments, as Fran said, both your arguments and the other side. In fact, know the other side's arguments better, because both sides are going to be heard from. And understand that the other side's argument probably has some validity. I mean, you may find that hard to believe, but in general, when things rise to a political situation, it's because legislators are making judgments. And legislators, ultimately, and government officials are about resource allocation. Who gets the money? And who keeps them and gets the programs from that money? And there's only so much of that about. So, you know, just try to keep that in mind. Also, when you talk to legislators, make the ask. At the end of the meeting or before the meeting ends, say what it is you want the legislator. I want you to support this bill. I want you not to support this bill. What will the legislator do? He will try to avoid a commitment, because 24 hours is a lifetime in politics. But at least make the ask. And then, regardless of the answer, be able to deal with it. If the member says, I'm behind you 100%, you can count on me, then say, thank you very much, Senator. I look forward to meeting you again. Stop talking. Don't make any more sales once your prospect has said okay. However, if you get the other answers, if they say, I'm not sure, I'm going to have to think about this, just ask them to contact you when they have made a decision. So say, I understand you've got to study the issue, but if you could get back to me, I would appreciate that. If they say, I've heard what you have to say, I happen to disagree, I'm going to vote against you, then say thank you very much, and I'll look forward to meeting you on another issue at another time, because there's always next time. And the last thing is, at least be aware of the political dynamics as you're going into a legislative session. Right now, one particular party happens to be politically dominant. Just understand that. As business people, you can't afford to belong to one political party or the other. you'll find that there aren't, on most business issues, a Republican way to do it or a Democratic way. There's a legislative way. And understand that and leave your partisan baggage at the door, especially in a state like New Jersey, which, having worked a few states, I will tell you that it is less volatilely partisan than a lot of states. I mean, partisan politics are played, but there are not as many ideologues in this legislature as there are in other parts of the country. So just try to get a little bit of handle on the political landscape, and with that, I'll turn it over to my chairman, Mr. Watkins.
There are two secrets to effective lobbying.
Didn't he tell us to stay seated?
But he doesn't pay attention.
One is to have good people working with you. I don't usually prepare notes for meetings because I rely upon these folks. We do a lot of lobbying together. I prepared four pages of notes today. I actually worked on it last night after watching 24. They said anything that I was going to say.
That's right.
They do a pretty good job. The second thing is find out who the golfers are in the legislature and make sure you play golf. Did everybody hear me?
Yeah, they can hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. Podcast. This is high tech stuff. Okay. I'm just going to review a few things. Keep it simple. Make sure when you're talking to legislators that you talk not down to them or down to a lower level, but talk in a level that they can understand. Avoid the jargon. Both Fran and Rick said that, but it's important. What's important to me, to my company, is not necessarily important to the legislature. Rick mentioned that they've got lots of issues, probably hundreds if not thousands of issues they're dealing with. Yours is probably not at the top of their list. So you need to put yourself in their shoes and understand the issues from their perspective. Frame the issue so there's something in it for them, that they win, that it's their idea that now they can move forward with. Never mislead, never threaten a legislator. Very bad move. Fran mentioned, make sure you tell them who the opposition is and understand the opposition's arguments and make sure that they understand them and know how to respond to them, because I've seen people do it, they've won, and they'll say, well, we're not going to talk about this because that's what the other people are going to say. These people that you're lobbying are not stupid. There are people coming in giving the other side of the story that are as effective, well, maybe not as effective as us, but they're effective. So the argument's going to come up sooner or later. It's better for you to try to help that person deal with the opposition on these issues. Don't assume that he or she knows much or anything about your business, and explain your business and your issues in terms that are understandable to them. Put it in perspective. Rick mentioned the importance of developing the relationship before you need the ask. All of you are business people. You're constantly dealing with other business folks. Sooner or later, you're going to ask them to do something. Who do you want to help when somebody asks you to do something? The guy that you've never met before, or the person that you've met and you have a relationship with and that you trust? You want to help the people you like. So this is difficult for me because I have to get people to like me, but get people to like you because it's easier for people to help people that they like. You got to be credible. If they don't believe you, we have nothing as lobbyists. We have nothing but our credibility. People don't believe you and trust you, you can't be very effective at this job. Governor Florio stole one of my quotes about, you know, democracy not being a spectator sport. Rick stole the second one about not wanting to see either legislation or sausage being made. The only one that's left is one that you've all heard, and that is Tip O'Neill's "All Politics is Local." But it is. It gets down to that personal relationship. We professional lobbyists get a bad rap because, you know, we're doing evil things. Everybody, every organization, every citizen has a right, an obligation to play in this game. And if we don't do it, the opposition sure as hell is doing it. I'm going to close with, I got two other things I want to talk about. Am I okay on time?
You're okay.
Just to give you a sense of how you can influence the process, think about this. Elected officials, their job is to get reelected. How do they get reelected? They get 50% of the vote plus one more vote in every election. That's all you got to do. Think about this in terms of the importance of not massive groups, but manageable numbers of people influencing the process. Less than 50% of the people who are eligible to vote even register to vote. So a smart politician right away knows half the people that are of voting age, he or she doesn't even, almost can ignore. Of the 50% that register to vote in a presidential election year, about half of them, maybe 60%, show up and vote. Wipe off another 40 to 50% of the electorate. You don't have to pay much attention to them. It's getting down to a much smaller number that a smart politician knows how to, you know, that he has to deal with. So you got half of the eligible voters, round numbers here, half the eligible voters that actually register, half of the ones that register actually vote. So you're down to 25% of all eligible voters are the people that the elected officials should pay attention to. Those are the people that's who he's doing business with, he or she's doing business with. So you have to win 12.5% plus one of all eligible voters, and you win an election. So the point being that to influence the process, who do legislators pay attention to? They pay attention to the people that vote. So if you can organize enough people to move that needle of that 12.5% plus one of all eligible voters, they'll pay attention to you. Lastly, let me just say a couple of characteristics. Lobbying is an investment. Sometimes it's a long-term investment. The relationships that you develop, you may not call upon those relationships for years, but you'll call upon them sooner or later. You got to be very patient, and you got to be very humble, because it takes long times for things to develop. And I've been doing this for almost 20 years now. I've lost more than I've won, and I think I'm a pretty good lobbyist. But that you got to have some humility to endure in this. And lastly, you got to have perseverance and determinations, because if you can't accept the defeats and go with the flow, it gets awfully frustrating, and I don't think you can be very effective. That's enough.
Thank you so much. Let me just make a couple of observations and reinforce some of the messages that you just heard before I throw out the first question. First of all, calling legislators and policymakers and other folks by their proper title is absolutely the right way to go. And I'll tell you a little story. When senators get together in their own private little room, when there's nobody else around but senators, they address each other as senator. Let me tell you a little story about how important it is to be a constituent and to be a constituent who is heard. When Jack Collins was Speaker of the General Assembly and I was his chief of staff for 6 years, for five of those years, the doctors in the state of New Jersey tried to get legislation passed that would allow them to collectively bargain so that they could get together as a group and collectively bargain with HMOs. Well, nobody thought that, you know, they would do that in order to lower their prices. They just thought it would mean higher prices. And so we weren't about to pass that bill. And it was bottled up for 5 years as a result of that. Speaker Collins happened to be home one day, and his eldest daughter's son was sick, and the eldest daughter wasn't able to take his grandchild to the physician, and asked if Speaker Collins would indeed take his grandson to the pediatrician. He did so while he was there. The pediatrician took the opportunity that presented itself and talked to Speaker Collins about that very bill and how important it was to her profession and to physicians across the state. When he went home that day, he called me and told me to post that bill for the very next assembly session, and that's how that bill got passed. And so you need to take your opportunities. And third, never, ever make enemies in this business. And when we took control of, when Republicans took control of the General Assembly and after the elections in 1991, and we decided to that it would be in our best interest to lower the sales tax from 7 to 6%, we were scrambling for every dollar we could find. And I got a call from the man who hired me, a fellow by the name of Chuck Hardwick, who was the Speaker of the General Assembly. And he was now with Pfizer Pharmaceutical. And he said, I got an idea. I got an idea that's going to save you millions of dollars in the budget. I want you to have it as a favor to me here. I mean, as a favor here, take this idea. And so we did that, and we bought into it. Well, it turns out that the idea had winners and losers, and there were some losers in the industry and some winners. Pfizer wound up being a winner, of course, because that's who he worked for. When I attended the Council of State Governments meeting in Boston that very summer, there was a lobbyist on one of the for one of the losers who undressed me in a rather public and humiliating way in front of others, and there wasn't a lobbyist who had favor in my office for a long, long time. Can you... You probably even know who it is. Can you...
no comment.
Can you tell us what the hot issues right now are for the industry and in the State House in Trenton? What's going on right now? What are you talking to legislators about? What should we be talking to legislators about, understanding that, you know, a week is a lifetime when it comes to politics, in June when we have our Trenton Day?
Again, they let me go first. I think some of the issues that probably affect a lot of the people in this room versus what some of the things that we might be talking about, they might affect you also. But I think some of the things that maybe will affect you in your business are some of the issues you may want to bring up with them. One of them would be the new increase in the sales tax, which may probably tremendously affect much of what you do. It's only a penny. But when you take that penny and you multiply it over all the services and all of the components of your business, that could be quite sizable to many of you. Asking for a rationale for that from them probably will get you an answer something like, we are in a desperate straits for revenue, we have a difficult situation, we've had 6% for many years. And there's some other components out there. There's some other things we've learned as we've talked about the sales tax issue with some legislators, that there may be some interest in the legislature of reducing the sales tax but spreading it over more services, which would probably even affect more of you in this room, because some of the services that you currently now, you know, do not have to tax to your customers, you may end up doing that. So be prepared for that recommendation, because it could come up and it could be something you may want to ask. Is there, are there any other proposals on the table that the legislature may have at this time? There's also a corporate business tax addition of 2.5%, and that's not in addition to the current corporate business tax. It's after you've determined the tax, then you tack on another 2.5, which may, depending on the size of your business, the type of the way you're incorporated, et cetera, may mean a sizable increase for you. Granted, there were some tax issues for business that were relinquished this year and will not be continued. The net operating losses was put aside. Obviously, it was a year late. They promised to do it last year, but at least this year they did it. And the alternative minimum tax is no longer going to be applied as well. So those two things were supposed to help business feel comfortable that the governor was on our side and that this is a good place to do business. However, as you start to calculate those numbers, you may not feel that way. And if you have issues regarding that, you need to voice them. You need to help them understand that you have high costs in running your companies, and they need to understand what those costs are, whether they're fixed, whether they're variable, and how they impact, and maybe how they may impact your ability to hire new employees, how it may impact you having to change the way you deliver health care in your companies. They need to know how this impacts your business. That's what you really need to explain to them, because like Rick said, they have a lot on their plate. They talk environment one day, health the next, you know, agriculture the next. They're over here with education, capital construction. They have so much on their plate that you need to simplify the tax issues or whatever other issues you might bring to them, especially the tax issues. They need to know how those affect whether you're small, medium, or a large company, because they'll affect you maybe differently than they would affect a pharmaceutical company, but certainly they impact us. In terms of the other issue that we're lobbying currently is the fact that in the budget there is an estimate savings that our industry is supposed to be contributing to the budget, and we are now working on explaining to them that the proposal they have set forth is simply those savings are not achievable, that the numbers do not meet. Now, that's a tough argument because they've already booked it as part of the governor's recommendation. But remember one thing. The legislature is now in charge of the budget. Governor Corsine has said in many public statements that he is going to be a leader and forge ahead, and he's going to get it done. He's going to do tough things in tough times. However, don't forget there's another branch of government. And the legislature now has the budget in their hands. They have the ability to massage that budget, to look at it, to analyze it, to look at it in a different way than the executive branch did, and to come up with ways they think is the better representation of what this state needs and what it stands for. So you have an opportunity to talk to them about what you think, you know, should be in that budget for business, and to share your particular business interests with them would be very important at this time. And maybe, you know, even if you have constituent relationships between before you go to Trenton, you might want to even reach out before that, because by June 10th, did you say, Don, they're in Trenton?
June 8th, hopefully.
Oh, June 8th. They're starting to craft the budget around that time and starting to draft the bill and getting it all ready and massaging the numbers. So there's still time to impact the bottom line of that budget. So with that being said, those are some of the things we're working on. Jim, if you want to add, I probably missed one or two in there. But those are some of the things we're working on now. And there's also maybe Senate 744. Maybe somebody wants to talk about that, the Walmart bill. What's that, he says? Because that would impact some people in this room as well.
Do you want? Because I can throw out another
question. I can do that, too.
Okay. Well, let me just throw out another question, and then we'll take some questions from the audience because our time is scarce. It's a loaded question. Do you have to make large contributions to legislators in order to gain access to them?
No. But it doesn't hurt. Political contributions never win the day. I used to be, for a while, it's not in my bio, but I used to be 6'9" and have jet black hair. And then I ran Johnson & Johnson's Political Action Committee and spent a lot of time asking scientists to make political contributions. And they would look at me like, what?
What
does a political contribution do? It tells a member that you understand that that member needs to get elected in order to do his business. If you make a contribution to a member, staff and the member are more apt, when they look at the 100 people that want to see him on a given day, to say, that company, that individual, and you can make contributions yourselves, and I'd encourage you, at least to your local person if you like them, will say, that person's been my friend once. Let's put him on the top of the agenda, and let's give her 30 minutes as opposed to 15 minutes. If your argument stinks or it's running against the public tide, it doesn't matter. But it will give you the opportunity to get in there and frame your argument and maybe get in there before the other side gets in there. It's important, but it... Believe me, if it won the day, there would be certain industries that never would have taken a loss politically.
Right.
And I will tell you, this industry's taken plenty of losses politically. But it doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt, and you need to be strategic, though, I think, in your contributions. I think you need to ask yourself, okay, which legislators, which chairs of which committees, which leadership individuals do I really need to support or talk to first? Get their viewpoints about my business or what my issues are, and then decide who you're going to spend your money on, because there are some that will be better for you than others. Obviously, the Speaker and the Senate President, they all get everyone's support. But there are committee chairs that you can work very closely with on issues when the bill's in that committee and you want to either amend it or kill it or do something. Those are the people you need to start asking yourself, the chair of the Health Committee, the chair of the Transportation Committee, the chair of Economic Development, people who work on committees that affect you. And if you don't have you can get little legislative directories from the Chemistry Council of New Jersey, the New Jersey Business and Industry Council, the South Jersey Chamber. They all put these little books out, and these are invaluable little books to keep and to talk about. What's in this book is invaluable to you because it tells you the who's who. And this is what you need to familiarize yourself with. And like we said earlier in our previous discussion is get to know them proactively. Try to be proactive instead of reactive. Be very proactive in reaching out to them initially, like Rick and Jim said. And then when you need to, you know, get to them for an issue, the door is open whether you made a contribution yesterday or last year. Because once you build that relationship and they trust you, they will remember that when you had more money in your pack or you had more money to contribute, you did. So if that year isn't good for you, but you've built the relationship, they will still open the door for you. And you'll still have that opportunity.
Two comments. One, part of the question was, does it take large sums of money? Rick answered the you know, saying that it helps to provide financial support, in particularly on a state level with individual legislators. Large sums of money, you know, we're not talking large sums of money. Most fundraisers are 500, maybe 1,000. So you're not talking about tens of thousands of dollars going into individual legislators. So, you know, a couple hundred bucks investment to support someone who supports you on positions and is in a position to make something happen is all that it takes to develop that financial relationship, which is a necessary part of the political process. Two other points. We don't set the rules and the regulations for how the political game is played. Someone else does that. We can influence it, obviously. But the rules of the game are set. The important thing is, as in any sport, is to play as aggressively as you can within the rules of the game. So do what the law and the regulations allow you to do. Be aggressive at it. And the last point about political contributions is a lot of legislators have golf outings, so it's a good way to play golf.
All right, we have time for just one or two questions from the audience.
Yeah, we need to hear from you guys, I think.
Please, over here. If you can identify yourself.
Wait for the
yourself,
mic, please.
My name's Denise Wills, and I own Extraordinaire Consultancy.
Are you close to the Lord?
I think something's going on there.
And what my business does is we provide expertise to pharmaceutical companies for developing their drugs, and my particular expertise is in oncology. I get the sheets from the FDA all the time, and one of the things that used to be talked about pretty frequently, but it's interesting you don't hear so much of, is the Canadian pharmacies. And the FDA has reported audit findings on these pharmacies where as much as 70% of the drugs aren't what they're supposed to be, or don't have the right chemical makeup that they should have. Whatever happened to that is that you hear about states talking about buying volumes of drugs from these pharmacies for their employees, and it's interesting to me that despite the FDA's findings, that things like that were still in discussion, but it's kind of died down now. So what's happened to that?
Well, two things, and then you guys can chime in. Two things from my perspective. One is, people did the argument that it was not only illegal but unsafe, I think, began to resonate with people. And the second thing is Medicare Part D came into play. This is a largely a political issue with the Medicare Part D drug benefit coming into play. Whether you agree that it's a good benefit or not, it's a benefit. Some people are getting their drugs that weren't getting them before. So I think it's kind of pulled the rug out from underneath it as a political issue.
It has. I agree with that. Yet there are some states, like I also have the state of Connecticut in my portfolio of states that I cover, and they're going to end their session this month, and there's a bill before them now that has many iterations. And the industry has worked very hard to dilute that bill because they want to verify certain internet pharmacies that they consider to be safe, because they want to be able to provide medications to other than just seniors who went on Part D. They want to be able to open it up to all the working people in the state to get lower prices. However, we remind them that our industry has various programs out there. I mean, Bob Franks mentioned RX for New Jersey, for New Jerseyans. We have PPARX.com, which is a website you can go to that has medications that are free or nearly free. There are patients' assistance, there are free drug programs that are listed there. And on that PPARX website, there are also some companies have programs that go up to 300% of poverty. So we've tried to explain to legislators there are other options other than putting patients in peril by having them get something off of an internet, which could be look, it could look good, it could look like the real thing, and even if they say it's the real thing and they verify it, it just might not be. Because there are even websites now that, let's say, a major department store like, oh, I don't know, Ladies Talbots, they have a website. Someone could actually duplicate that website. You could order something off of it, and it might not even be the real website. So there's a lot of concern about safety, and I think Jim pointed out that initially has always been the FDA rule, and all the things, the counterfeit things that they've found over the years. I know that Rudy Giuliani was in charge of a task force that did a lot of counterfeit work with the federal government, and they have found these drugs are not coming from Canada; they're coming from other places.
Great.
So we're trying very hard to kill that as much as we can.
We have time for one more. By the way, I do get a great number of emails about a certain type of drug that's manufactured by a competitor of yours. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Celia Morton from Autism Speaks, and I have a question for you. We recently lobbied in Washington, D.C. for the Combating Autism Act, and we had a particular senator's aide tell us that he had signed on the day before. Well, the results come out every Friday, and we've been checking, and he has not signed on. And so we're wondering, how exactly should we do our follow-up with that? Because, you know, you don't want to say you misled us, but they misled us.
What is your time frame? What is the time frame of that bill? How long? Where is the bill? Is it in a? Is it going to the floor for a floor vote? Is it just coming out of committee? Where is it? Do you know?
It is actually going to be going to the floor for a floor vote.
Oh. And he didn't sign on out of a committee or?
No, each person, each senator and congressman has a chance to sign on individually.
Oh, onto the bill.
Onto the bill.
As a co-sponsor.
Itself.
Oh, okay.
He said he would be a co-sponsor, and he hasn't co-sponsored.
Right.
All right. Well, let me put it this way. If there's still time to go back to him and respectfully say, oh, Senator, you know, we had, or his aide, we have spoken with you about this. Is there some reason why the senator has not signed on to the bill? I mean, you certainly have, in a very proactive, very congenial manner, to go back and inquire. There's really nothing wrong with that. Because your job is to follow up, follow up, follow up, follow up. Because they're not going to follow up with you. You have to do the follow up.
Right.
So I don't think, personally, as a lobbyist, I would be very happy to make that call if I were a lobbyyist and say, you know, I noticed the list came out and I didn't see you on it, and we really would so much appreciate your sponsorship, and we thought that you were going to sponsor it. Has there been a change of heart, and should we come back in and talk to you some more about it?
Right, because we were told he did sign on the day before, and I'm wondering if
it's okay to follow up.
Yeah, I would right. follow up. But you might want to even say, you know, we're getting ready to do a mailing. We're getting ready to contact our members, and we would love to list you indeed you are
personal.
A co-sponsor, as a co-sponsor of the bill, but we don't see it in the official congressional record. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to – let's give a big round of applause. This was very helpful. I've been excited about this next presentation since I had coffee with Steve at the – and if I have my direction correct – at the Borders over here about a month and a half ago. And I got an iPod for Christmas. I don't want this to be all about me, but I got an iPod for Christmas, and you know, the first thing I downloaded was the Fiesta Bowl highlights, Ohio State crushing Notre Dame, which I was very excited about. But then I went to the podcast section, and there was so much useful information there that you can search by category, and I was like, how do you get in on this? Well, we actually can find out about that. Steve Lubetkin is the managing partner of Lubetkin & Company. He's a technology-savvy veteran of more than 25 years in corporate and financial communications. He has experience in both print and broadcast journalism and an extensive background in reputation management, financial media relations, product media relations, speech and testimony writing, seminar and conference planning, issues management, and crisis public relations. He is a nationally published author and a frequent speaker at conferences and meetings on technology, financial communications, and public relations topics. Before Steve began doing what he's doing now, he was director of corporate communications for Fleet Bank's New Jersey and Pennsylvania franchise. He has been vice president and director of corporate communications for Summit Bancorp. He joined Standard & Poor's, the world's largest debt rating organization, as a senior speechwriter in 1991. He worked for Consolidated Rail Corporation. In 1999, Steve was recognized for his service to the public relations profession and his track record of accomplishments. He became, at age 42, the youngest public relations practitioner elected up to that time to the PRSA College of Fellows. From January 2003 to December 2005, he served on the PRSA National Board of Directors. His journalism background includes broadcast news reporting at WJLK and WRLB Radio in New Jersey, and print reporting at the Asbury Park Press and the Red Bank Register. He was also a contributor to the Associated Press, both print and broadcast services. Steve holds an MBA from the University of Phoenix, a pioneering institution of higher education offering advanced degrees through computer-assisted distance education classes, and a BA, which he graduated magna cum laude in Spanish and philosophy from Monmouth College, where my daughter went. Steve lives in Cherry Hill, and his wife, Judy, have two daughters, Sharon and Michelle. So, Steve, take it away.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? There are only a few real, truly terrifying things in life, and one of them is finding out that you're the only thing standing between the audience and lunch. So, with your indulgence, we will move forward. Blogs, podcasts, and wikis. Oh, my. We're going to talk about a few of these things, and if time permits, take some questions from you. I'm looking around the room, and I think most of you are old enough to remember a movie character popular in the 70s, Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry. And many of you probably know the very, very famous catchphrase from the Dirty Harry movies that was repeated over and over again by one of our more recent presidents. That's not the line I want to bring to your attention. In the second Dirty Harry movie, Dirty Harry was fighting against a group of rogue police officers led by his boss, Hal Holbrook, who was a police lieutenant. These rogue officers were going around conducting summary executions of felons who were getting off on technicalities because of the interest in civil rights and protecting the rights of the accused. And this group of motorcycle police ended up in a life and death chase scene at the end of the movie, which is predictable. And when it was all said and done, of course, Dirty Harry is the only one left standing. And the rogue officers and Hal Holbrook are floating in San Francisco Bay, and Harry looks over and says the second most famous line in the Dirty Harry movies, "Man's gotta know his limitations." And that's what I'd like you to use to frame your expectations about blogs and podcasts and what they can do for your business and for your communications with clients and customers. Blogs are basically online journals. They're online diaries that people create. And they've been doing this for a number of years, ever since the web became popular in the early 90s. The difference today is that you don't have to be a technology guru to create a web diary. In the early days, you kind of had to know a little bit about the HTML code that's used to create websites. You had to have a little bit of technical expertise to load the pages on the website. And it was really a tedious process. So what tended to happen was people got very enthusiastic in the beginning, and then they started to fade after a few months of having to laboriously code the pages and upload them and so forth. But what's happened recently is you now have websites that help you build blogs using the web browser as your word processor. So you don't have to know the code. You don't have to design the pages. They do that for you, and you can choose from any one of dozens of designs at any of the popular sites that provide blogging support. You can change the design with a mouse click. So if you don't like the design, you just click and you've got something completely different. But what's happened is that the blogosphere is heavily populated. It's overpopulated. The last time I looked at one of the popular search engines about the blogosphere, Technorati, which I'll show you in a minute, they counted approximately 36 million blogs. And I would suggest to you that there are nowhere near 36 million people reading those blogs. So
what tends to happen is there are a lot of blogs that go unread or unremarked, and there are a few that get a lot of attention. And they get attention out of proportion to their influence and relevance in modern life. And the ones that get the attention tend to be the ones that are most polarized. When I worked in the financial industry, the head of our credit card business said that the really good groups to create affinity credit cards were the groups that were very, very passionate about their topics. And so we were very, very successful at Fleet having affinity credit cards for two groups at opposite ends of the political spectrum. We had an affinity card for the National Rifle Association, very passionate group, right? And at the other end was Greenpeace. And both of those were highly profitable credit card portfolios for the company. So passionate and at opposite ends of the spectrum. The political blogs tend to be very popular, but they also tend to be very shrill. It's a lot of screaming at each other. There's the blogs on the right are screaming at the blogs on the left, and there's not a lot of productive dialogue going on, but they do get attention from the media. The hysterical aspect of it we saw recently when Jill Carroll, the freelance writer for the Christian Science Monitor, was released from having been kidnapped by some terrorists in Iraq. And some of the right-wing bloggers couldn't wait to get out in their blogs with comments suggesting that she had somehow been unpatriotic because of statements that she made or videotapes that she made with her captors while they were holding a gun to her head. It was Senator McCain, who himself had spent 5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, who brought some sanity to the discussion by saying that in the last 10 years, no one has ever questioned statements made by a hostage while they were being held hostage. And it was a radical departure from past practice. And the right-wing bloggers rightly took some heat for jumping the gun on that. I said that blogs have influence out of proportion to their readership, and here are three examples. On the left-hand side of the screen is Eason Jordan. He was the vice president of news at CNN. And in the middle of last year, he was a panelist at a meeting not unlike this one in Switzerland, where he was heard by most people in the audience to suggest that the U.S. military was conducting deliberate targeted attacks on journalists covering the war, that they were trying to kill journalists. He was called out on that allegation by one of the other panelists and made a half-hearted effort to withdraw it. But the organizers of the conference had provided press credentials to a number of bloggers for that conference. And these were bloggers on both ends of the political spectrum. And the right-wing conservative bloggers wrote about Eason Jordan's comment. And eventually, it took about 3 or 4 days, but the mainstream media did pick it up. They tried to avoid it, it seems, because they felt that he had tried to say, I misspoke, and sort of apologized. But ultimately, the Wall Street Journal wrote about it, and ultimately, Eason Jordan lost his job. So a great deal of influence from the bloggers, and it would not have been covered by the mainstream press if the bloggers hadn't brought it to people's attention. The second item on the right side of the screen, the kryptonite bicycle lock. Do we have any bike riders here? Anybody here have a kryptonite bicycle lock? Have you had it replaced in the last year? You may want to contact the company, because a little over a year ago, a blogger writing for a blog called Engadget.com discovered that these very, very reputable and supposedly impermeable bicycle locks could be defeated by taking the complicated and highly skilled professional tool you see laying on the lock in the picture, the Bic pen, and jamming it into the cylinder of the lock. You could break the lock open. And to make sure that everybody understood that this was possible, he made a video of this procedure and put it on his blog. And in the course of a year's time, the kryptonite lock folks had to recall millions of locks at a cost of, most people think, was millions of dollars. Again, on a much more minor level, in the middle of the screen, you see a blog written by a friend of mine, Robert George, who is an editorial page editor at the New York Post. He's one of the few African-American conservative editorial writers in the country, still standing. And he had picked up on something that I pointed out in my blog, and it was a minor issue involving a factual error in the New York Times. I approached the Times about it, trying to go through the normal channels. I'm a PR guy, you know, you try to do the normal things because you don't want to irritate the media. So I sent an email to their corrections editor saying, please correct this. I heard nothing. I called the phone number that they list in the paper for corrections and left a detailed voicemail, including a callback number. I heard nothing. I finally wrote an email to Daniel Okrent, who at that time was the public editor, the ombudsman for the New York Times, and I said, you know, I've written to your corrections editor, I've left a voicemail. If you don't respond to me, I'm going to blog about this. In 24 hours, I had an email from Daniel Okrent and I had an email from Bill Borders, the corrections editor, explaining how they were going to handle the situation. On a similar note, more recently, and this is not a true story, there was an item in the Metropolitan Diary column in the New York Times. Everybody read that? It's a cute little column they run once a week of little anecdotes that are supposed to have happened to people in and around New York, in and around the metropolitan area. And the first item in the column caught my eye. A woman was describing how she had gone into a public restroom, and all of a sudden a voice from the next cubicle starts asking her questions, which she politely responds to. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, the voice says, listen, I have to call you back. The idiot in the next stall keeps answering my questions. And they published that story in the New York Times. Well, you know, within about 2 minutes, I was able to Google. My mother has sent me that story on the internet. Okay, that story has been circulating as a joke on the internet for at least 10 years. I even found one reference to it where a Berkeley professor told the story in a commencement address as if it happened to him. And he was a professor of urban legends. So, you know, so I blogged about it, and some of the other bloggers picked up on it. The only blogger who did anything useful with this information, by the way, was a professional journalist blogger, Dan Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer, who actually tracked down the woman whose name was attached to it and interviewed her. And her response to him was, yeah, I sent it to the Times, but I just told them it was a funny story and they should publish it as something that might happen to somebody. I never said it happened to me. And it took 3 or 4 days, and the Times ran a very bland correction, said nothing about the blogosphere discussion about it. They just said the story was published, and it's a story that's been circulating for some time. It shouldn't have been published, but that was the end of that. So the point being, blogs can affect things in the real world, and they do, and you need to be aware of these conversations going on as they affect your organizations. However, there is a downside to blogging, and there is a backlash coming from the mainstream media. This column appeared in the Inquirer last week, right before I spoke to another group about blogs, and basically, the issue of blogging is that bloggers don't play by the same rules as journalists. So there's a credibility question. Many of us don't track down the woman who sent the item in and ask her about it. Many bloggers speculate about things without calling the person or contacting the person to ask what's going on here, what's the true story. There was a similar piece in the Wall Street Journal recently which talked about the blogosphere, we call it, the universe of blogs, as being a place where disinhibition reigns. And they said it's sort of like if everybody all at once started behaving like Paris Hilton and South Park all the time. And there's a lot of that going on in the blogosphere. However, when we get to podcasts, here's the thing you need to know. Podcasts have gone mainstream. And I'm very happy to say the proof of that is that I got the Philadelphia Business Journal to write about my podcast. So if anybody wants a copy, I have copies of that. It's in this week's issue of the Business Journal. This is a chart produced by a company called FeedBurner, which provides some of the technical services that bloggers and podcasters need to distribute their content. FeedBurner has been tracking the number of people subscribing to what they call rich media feeds. Rich media is a service, a distribution, if you will, of a podcast or a video podcast. And as you can see on the left-hand side of the chart, we're talking last January, 05. And if you look at the right-hand side of the chart, you're looking at March of this year. So there's a dramatic growth in the number of people who are starting to listen to podcasts or look for podcasts. And we think that's encouraging because it means that people are starting to get it. How do you find blogs? I mentioned Technorati. Technorati is a search website very much like Google, except that it focuses on blogs. You go to Technorati, you put in a search term, and it will tell you where conversations about that search term are happening. Back in the early 90s, there was a similar sort of technology that people use. Anybody here remember the Usenet? Okay. This still exists today. There are 35,000 special interest groups talking in cyberspace about different topics. And I remember hearing about the Usenet at the time, and people were having conversations about things like fly fishing. And they were talking about the relative merits of different types of fishing rods and reels and other equipment, and trashing them for their performance problems. And the person who was speaking about it at a conference I attended said, I'm absolutely certain that the fishing rod and reel company has no idea that these conversations are going on. And they're going to see their sales fall off the chart and wonder why. So it's a good idea to go to Technorati, take a look at what they're saying about your issues or your companies or your organizations if you're not a company. Just put in the terms. And you can actually set up alerts that will send you an email or send you an item in your subscription feed, and I'll get to that in a minute, if something comes up. Are there pharmaceutical blogs? Of course. There are at least 128,000 postings on Technorati that use the word pharmaceutical. This is one example of one blog, and people set up blogs because they're interested in the subject. If you've read The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, he talks about people who are passionate about specific topics and about how it's more important to reach those people than to reach a mass audience. You're better off having 200 people read your blog or listen to your podcast than having millions of people, most of whom don't really care. There are a bunch of different pharmaceutical blogs, as a matter of fact. The one on the left side of the page is called Your Pharmacist May Hate You. And I'm not quite sure what he's writing about, but it has a lot to do with, you know, the issues that people face when they are filling prescriptions. On the right side, we have one called PharmaWatch, which is just looking at all things pharmaceutical. Talk a little bit about podcasts. Podcasts are nothing more than digital audio files. Your kids know them as MP3s. That's the standard file format that's used. We create these files, and then we distribute them in a couple of ways. You post a link on a website, and people can click on the link, and depending on how your computer's configured, one of two things will happen. It will either open up the audio player software on your computer and start playing the file, or it will ask you if you want to download the file. And you can download the file and play it later, and that's what a lot of people do. They download the file and then transfer it to a digital audio device. The fact that we call it a podcast, by the way, doesn't mean that it is restricted to being played only on an Apple iPod. It can be played on any digital audio player device that plays MP3 files. The second way that podcasts are distributed is through something called RSS. I mentioned earlier the feeds or the feed. RSS is the acronym for this technology, which involves making people aware that new content has been produced. RSS, by the way, stands for Really Simple Syndication. They come up with acronyms sometimes in technology because they think they need to. Years ago, how many of you own a scanner for your computer? In all likelihood, your scanner in its documentation will tell you that it is a Twain-compatible scanner, spelled like Mark Twain. Twain is an acronym that stands for Technology Without an Impressive Name. So, you know, they needed to get something on the program to get it out the door. That's what they came up with. And now it's an industry standard, right? What happens in an RSS feed, it's a piece of HTML code. It's a little more complicated than HTML, but it's basically the same thing. When you create a blog posting, every time you put up a new item on the blog, it changes this other piece of HTML code that's sitting out on another web page. Because you're doing that, people have created software applications that can look at that other piece of code, and if it changes, they get a message back. And the message comes to them in the form of what looks like an email message. People use software called a feed reader or a podcatcher, and they call it podcatcher because it's a feed reader that can download podcasts. This is one feed reader called FeedDemon. And basically, the interface is very much like what you would expect to see in an email program. On the left side, you have a bunch of folders. On the right side, you have a preview pane and a series of items. And each time, if you've decided to, and the word is subscribe, even though there's no money changing hands, if you've decided to subscribe to the feed for one of my podcasts, you're telling this software, keep an eye on his podcast page, on this code, this RSS code, and if it changes, let me know. That's all it's doing. So when I post a new podcast, you get a little email item in the inbox that says, new podcast. And if you've set up the software properly, it'll automatically download the file. Now, the file isn't actually coming into your email, and this is where the advantage of this distribution mechanism comes in. In the early years, when people were trying to send stuff like this to people that they hoped would be interested in it, they actually had to send them the file. And I will tell you that audio files can be very large. Some of the files that I've created have been as large as 100 or 125 megabytes. You don't want to send that to somebody by email. Most companies limit your inbox to about 40 megabytes. So you don't want to do that. So how do you do it? You send them this RSS feed, which all it's doing is sending you a placeholder, a bookmark, for where the podcast actually is. It's not actually sending you the file. And when you're ready to get the file, you download it with your Podcatcher software, and what you see here is the same feed daemon. On top of it is its separate but connected application called FeedStation, and it's downloading a number of podcasts. These are all MP3 files being downloaded. And it puts them in a folder that you designate. It will even set up a playlist of these files to be loaded into your digital music device. And that's how you get your podcasts. And again, just like finding blogs and finding other things on the web, there are search engines available and directories. Podcast Alley is a popular place for podcasters to put their listings for their programs, and their programs on almost every subject you can imagine. And I will talk about those briefly. Podcast Pickle and Odeo, everybody thinks we have to have a compelling and cute brand name. I don't know why. The gold standard is iTunes. iTunes is the software that comes with your Apple iPod, if you get one. And you can download the iTunes software for free and install it on your computer, even if you don't have an iPod. And I'd actually encourage you to do that. I don't get any money from Apple for saying that, but they actually have some streaming radio stations you can listen to and some other content that's pretty interesting. Last fall, Apple upgraded the software to enable podcasters to distribute their programs through iTunes. And this is a really interesting audience for those of us who do podcasts because there are 7 million pairs of ears subscribing to this store. And you get to get in there and potentially get in front of them for free. You just have to know how to do it. That's why people hire me. So when you get into iTunes, you have all kinds of interesting podcasts. Back in the early 70s, when cassette recorders first became really cheap and people wanted to, you know, have a fun time with them, they'd bring them home and they would talk dirty into them and play it back to their friends and family, and everybody got a hoot hearing, you know, dirty words coming out of a tape recorder. A lot of podcasts are like that right now. One of the most popular is the Dawn and Drew Show. Dawn and Drew are a 20-something couple who live in a farmhouse in Wisconsin. They podcast from their kitchen and mostly talk about their private life in graphic detail. And they get hundreds of thousands of listeners. Some people want to listen to this, and that's okay. It's out there. It's available. That's great. There are some other things that are a little bit more interesting. I listened to one called The Catholic Insider. This is a Catholic priest in the Netherlands, Father Roderick, who does podcasts about all kinds of spiritual and religious things. He did an especially compelling series of programs from the Vatican during the time the Pope had died and the new Pope was being elected, including a podcast that he recorded live in the crowd in St. Peter's Square the day the new Pope was elected. And because he records with a high-quality digital stereo recorder, when you put earphones on, you really feel like you're in the crowd in St. Peter's Square. There are pharmaceutical podcasts. I will leave it to you to find some. There's one called the Pharmacy Benefits Podcast, and Medical Science Liaison Quarterly has launched a continuing medical education series of podcasts. And that's a particularly good way to use podcasts, by the way, is to distribute information if you're a pharma company or a company with a lot of salespeople on the road and you need to get them information but you don't want to bring them in for a meeting. You want to get it to them. They don't want to listen to a conference call. They're all driving. Think about podcasts. They can listen to it in the car. Corporate use of podcasts, I'm happy to say, is rising. We've been doing podcasts for Sun National Bank, We do them for Rutgers Camden. As Frank Keith knows, we just completed the second quarter quarterly business outlook podcast. We had over 500 downloads of the first quarter podcast, and we're on track to do at least that many from the second quarter. And these are people who are listening to a two-hour program because they want that content. And we just completed one for Ace Insurance in Philadelphia as well. Wikis, I will just tell you, is a collaborative tool. I don't want to take up too much time on it. It's something that you might think about looking into for teams of people that are collaborating on different projects within your organizations. And I will leave you with one anecdote about the iPod and podcasting, and that is my daughter Shelley and her iPod. A few weeks ago, when I was first getting the podcasts loaded into the iTunes Music Store, I wanted to make sure it was working. So at the time, her computer was the only computer in the house that had iTunes software on it. So I set it up to download my podcasts and load them in her iPod. And she came down to breakfast one morning and she says, "Dad, your podcasts are in my iPod. My friends were listening to them and laughing. I was so embarrassed." And I said, what any good PR guy would say, take the negative and make it a positive, right? I said, "Shelley, your answer to them is, at least my dad has a podcast. Does yours?" And she looked at me like a 16-year-old can look at her dad and said, "That argument will never work. Don't ever use that again." Thank you very much.
Questions?
I'll come right over to you.
Two questions. One, to what extent for blogs and podcasts is there now money in it? To what extent is there any kind of advertising or subscription? Just kind of a guess on your part from what you've observed. Secondly, for blogs particularly, do you have any sort of intellectual property protection, copyrights or anything like that, or is it not protected information?
The first question, advertising, podcasters and bloggers are all interested in sponsorship and advertising opportunities, so if anyone wants to advertise on our podcast, we'd be happy to talk to you about that. But the advantage for the podcaster is that we don't have to charge a lot of money for advertisers or sponsors, and people are starting to look at that as a real opportunity to reach audiences that they might not otherwise reach. The Dawn and Drew show, whatever you think of what they're doing, has been successful with a niche audience because they did pick up a sponsorship that's reported to have been in the mid five figures from a company that manufactures condoms. And they agreed to demo the condoms in their podcasts and other products. And I guess, you know, more power to them. So that's a possibility. The second question about intellectual property, the big issue for a lot of people is that MP3 files are easily transferable. A copy of an MP3 is an identical file to the original, so podcasters don't do a lot of use of copyrighted music because the music industry frowns on that. There is a whole genre of music that has grown up called pod-safe or pod-friendly music that people download, and the bands encourage you to use in your podcasts and feature, you know, as featured artists. And so there's an interesting whole buzz marketing going that way, but you don't have a way to lock it down. If you want to lock down content, there are some proprietary tools you can use. There's a whole genre of stuff called digital rights management that will enable you to do that, but a lot of listeners don't like that because it does nasty things to their computers sometimes. Sony got in a lot of trouble by secretly installing digital rights management software on people's computers when they bought Sony CDs. So you want to be careful about how you implement something like that.
One more. Couple of housekeeping things before. Well, first of all, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this second installment of South Jersey Pharmapod. It's the official podcast of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. We'd like to thank Don and Joyce Seco, executive directors of the Alliance, for their assistance in the production of these programs. If you want more information on the Alliance, please visit www.sjpmtia.org. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to learn more about how to incorporate podcast programming in your business communications plans, please email me at steve@lubetkin.net. That's LUBETKIN.net. For more information on our podcasting and other communication services, please visit www.lubetkin.net. In our third episode of South Jersey PharmaPod, we'll present the panel of South Jersey legislators who finished up the spring conference for the Alliance, talking about issues that are important to businesses in the southern part of the Garden State. We produce these programs in our studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.